Tom Guidoboni arrived home in Arlington, Virginia late Friday night, exhausted after a 2-day trip to Texas, where he had been taking depositions in a new case. When the 41-year-old defense lawyer got up the next morning, his wife was absorbed in a newspaper story about a virus that had crippled computers around the nation. "This is fascinating," she said, pushing the article toward her husband. It was the first Guidoboni had heard of the incident. "What's so fascinating about it?" He took a quick look and went back to his coffee. "Well," explained his wife, also a lawyer, "whenever I call the court to ask for something, they always say they can't answer because the computer is down. Or you get a computer on the telephone. Now thousands of computers are down because of this one thing." But her husband was already lost in another section of the paper. 2 hours later, the telephone in the Guidoboni house rang. It was a partner from his firm wanting to know if Guidoboni would be interested in representing the virus kid. An hour later, Guidoboni was on the phone with Bob Morris, and they arranged an appointment for 10 a.m. Monday. It wasn't clear to Guidoboni which law, if any, had been broken. Normally, if he got a weekend call on a criminal case, he knew instantly which section of the statute applied to the case. But this was new terrain for Guidoboni. He was familiar with basic wire fraud law, which was the first thing to come to mind after the conversation with his partner. Even as a criminal lawyer, he was only vaguely familiar with the existing computer crime statute. The next day, Guidoboni went to his office to read the law carefully and prepare for the meeting. The 1984 law, amended in 1986, was created in response to the public's demand for more computer crime protection. It was Congress's first attempt to criminalize computer trespass, making it a crime to gain unauthorized access to computer systems. The statute also made it a crime to modify, destroy, or disclose information gained from the authorized entry into a computer. As of 1988, the amended law was still largely untested. Only one case had gone to trial, none to a jury. But while other areas of criminal law tended to address narrowly defined, well-understood conduct, the computer fraud statute cast its net over a wide range of computer activities. The law's critics claimed that it was too broad and too vague, that it failed to define adequately such words as access and authorized. But Guidoboni, new to the subject, understood only that he would have to meet his prospective client and hear the facts before he could consider how the law might be applied. The first thing that struck Guidoboni when the Morris family entered his office was their unusual appearance. Robert, dressed in a navy jacket and narrow purple flowered tie, appeared to be in a state of shock, pale and drawn. He looked as if he hadn't slept or eaten in several days. Bob's eccentricities were evident from his long and unkempt beard, and Anne, heavy-set with graying blonde hair piled into a bun, came across as a forceful, educated woman concerned about her son. In contrast to Robert, the parents appeared to be relatively composed, although anxious about whether or not this stranger could help. Bob and Anne made it clear that what they were doing was a little hasty attorney shopping. One prominent Washington attorney had already offered to take the case pro bono, but the Morrises wanted to explore all of their options. Guidoboni took down some general information and asked Bob to explain his obligations to the National Security Agency with regard to the incident. The elder Morris responded that he felt obligated to tell law enforcement officials what he knew of the offense. Morris had already contacted the lawyers at NSA, and he had already spoken with the FBI. He said that he believed Robert should speak with the FBI as well. It is a common but often misguided impulse to go straight to the authorities with the whole truth, hoping for leniency in return, Guidoboni explained. He was quick to dissuade the elder Morris from that plan. The Morris family then interviewed Guidoboni. He told them he had attended the University of Virginia Law School, that he specialized in white-collar crime, and that with the exception of one computer-related case in 1981, his background in computers was minimal. They discussed his fees. The lawyer then excused both parents in order to have a private conversation with Robert. In some ways, Robert struck Guidoboni as the youngest 22-year-old he had ever met. Once the lawyer assured Robert that federal marshals weren't about to swoop down and carry him away, he relaxed a bit. Guidoboni had spent years learning to gauge potential clients, from street criminals to congressmen to corporate executives, and he could see through the overwrought facade to a young man who was not only very smart, but utterly without guile. Robert's main concern appeared to be whether he would get into trouble with Cornell. Once Guidoboni established that there didn't appear to be any national security risk involved, and that Robert's program hadn't affected any financial institutions, Guidoboni asked the young man to tell him who else knew firsthand that he had written and released the virus, and what they knew. Robert said that Paul Graham and Andy Suddeth knew the most about it. Then there were the others who he had told afterwards, David Hendler, Janet, and of course his father. Paul was the only one who knew about it beforehand. Guidoboni also wanted to know what tracks he had left. Robert said he had cleaned up a lot of files on his Cornell account, but someone there had obviously gone into his old files and found incriminating evidence. Guidoboni said that he considered this an indefensible means of collecting evidence. Cornell's claim that it has a right to search Robert's files because it owned the computers was, in the lawyer's view, preposterous. Scouring someone's personal computer files is as much a privacy breach as opening someone's personal mail or listening in on private telephone calls. As the conversation wore on, Guidoboni saw that Robert was only gradually beginning to see that this was a serious criminal offense. Until now, he hadn't even realized that anybody outside the computer community would pay much attention to the incident. It appeared likely to Guidoboni, in fact, that until Robert walked into the lawyer's office, he didn't know there was even a law to violate, and he certainly wasn't aware of the computer crime statute in particular. Guidoboni wanted the case. He knew it would be interesting and challenging. It was a rare opportunity to take on a piece of the law that had never been interpreted. He liked Robert, who was clearly intelligent without being arrogant, and the publicity couldn't hurt. The next day, he got a call from Bob Morris, asking him to proceed. The session with the lawyer had taken its toll on Robert. When the family got back to the metro station afterward, Robert collapsed. His anxious parents propped him up on a bench and waited for him to get his strength back before continuing the journey. When the Morrises returned home later that afternoon, a crowd of reporters, photographers, and television crews was waiting at the end of the driveway. Robert put his head in his hands. At first, it appeared to the journalists that the computer whiz might make a statement. Instead, he looked down at his feet, admitted in a barely audible voice that it had been a pretty rough day, and was escorted by his mother into the house.